Welcome back to the Animals at Home podcast. My name is Dylan Perrin, and thank you so much for tuning in today. Today, I'm speaking with Brandon Van Asten, who is the owner and operator of Canadian Cold Blood. Brandon is the most prolific tree monitor breeder on the planet. He's been breeding tree monitors for 12 years now. He currently works with all six species. In general, he has a ton of reptile breeding experience. He's been breeding reptiles since the 90s, many different reptiles or geckos and monitor species, but he has been focusing on tree monitors for the past 12 years. In the episode, we discuss how he got into tree monitor breeding and how he noticed some issues or mistakes people were making early on with tree monitor breeding that were giving hatchability issues, and he corrected those mistakes quite quickly, and this is what allowed him to have, you know, the foundation for the success he's had since then. We discuss the different species he keeps, their difference in behavior, color, obviously, how he cares for them, how he breeds them, the ethics of breeding such a advanced species, and how to make sure that those animals are actually going to the right home. Brandon is an incredible wealth of information. I encouraged him at the end of the episode that he should get into writing a book, because I think it would be very easy for him to do, because he is somebody who keeps such diligent notes. So if you're somebody that wants to work with tree monitor species or is attempting to breed them, this is an episode that will be for you. Even if you're someone that never, like me, probably will never keep a tree monitor just because I know it's not going to fit with my lifestyle, this is an incredibly fascinating episode, and you'll be able to pull out so much information that will translate to other species as well. Let's not get into any more detail. Let's just let Brandon speak for himself. Enjoy the episode. Awesome. Well, Brandon, welcome kind of back to the podcast. We did a semi-podcast back a few months ago live at the CRBE, but this is a first real episode. So welcome back to the show, and thank you for doing this.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Really looking forward to it. I mean, you're a very well-known name, especially now in the tree monitor space. Everybody knows Canadian Cold Blood, so it'll be really interesting to kind of hear some of the backstory and also, you know, what you're working on right now. I feel like when we chatted in September, maybe you implied, or maybe that was the sense I got, that you got into monitor breeding fairly early on in your reptile keeping career. I know you've been breeding monitors for a long time. Did you start breeding monitors relatively soon from your keeping time, or have you been keeping for a long time before that?
No, you know what? I think like my first reptile was, I couldn't even tell you what species it was. It was some fence lizard that you bought at a pet store, probably when my parents got it for me when I was maybe 10 or 11 years old, right? And I mean, that thing always fascinated me, but, you know, it was well before any knowledge I had of keeping and stuff. And then I progressed from that, and I was really, really interested back in probably the mid 90s, like maybe 94, 95, in chameleons. For some, I loved chameleons, just everything about them. And then that's when sort of veiled chameleons became available. And I saved and saved and saved for my first pair of veiled chameleons. And that was my first real foray into, like, okay, I did the research. I set up these nice setups with the goal of trying to propagate them, right? I think I had an old issue of Vivarium magazine that I read, and then there was a book about chameleons that I kind of got some information. And that was my first foray into, like, really trying to do well with the animals as a 15-year-old kid. And that worked out with veiled chameleons. They're not difficult to breed, but at the time it was kind of like a holy grail for me. And I was able to breed them. And then I remember the first clutch of eggs I got, I was like 52 eggs or something, and they all hatched, right? It was crazy. That was back in the day where I was like, oh man, these things are expensive to feed. And I'm, you know, 16 or 15 maybe. And I'm like, man, I have to feed these things, right? So it's like, they're eating thousands of crickets a week, all these babies. And now I have to try and sell them, right? Like, I have to get rid of them. And that was before the internet really was commonly available. That was before Kijiji and all that stuff. So I literally had to go to the phone book and call up pet stores and be like, hey, would you be interested in some veiled chameleons like this? And it deals over the phone. And then I get my mom to drive me to like a PJ's, you know, and a Big Al's and sell them. Right. And that's how I did it. But, you know, then I was like, oh, this is a little bit of a business now too, right? So, and then from there, the next thing that really caught my attention, it always fell on the back of like Reptiles magazine, right? Because whatever was the feature article was usually something pretty cool back in the day. And then it was frilled lizards. And man, frilled lizards were that thing. And And I had to get a few frilled lizards, and it kind of just worked out from there. I had frilled lizards, then a few geckos, and then probably about, I would say it was probably about 5 years into kind of the chameleons and frilled lizards. That's when the ackies came on the scene in like the late 90s. And yeah, I was fascinated by the ackies and monitors. And then I was able to get my first pair of ackies. I think Port Credit Pet Center brought them in like 1998 or 99 or something, and I was able to get a couple of those animals, and then the rest is history. I've never not bred ackies since that point.
Right? That is wild.
Had them, yeah.
So you kind of hit the ground running with breeding. I mean, it's funny thinking of you as a 15 or 16 year old. It's almost like you just want to try to see if you're capable of doing it, but you don't actually think about the result of having to deal with 52 babies suddenly. And
that wasn't the goal, right? It wasn't the goal of like selling babies. It was just like, you know, I think that's the goal of anybody who's trying to do right by it, like the reptile that they have. If, you know, I think for my intents and purposes, the standard of like quality of care would be reproduction in captivity, right? If your animals are happy and healthy and all that stuff, then they can reproduce. Never kind of thought about the back end of it, like, oh, what am I going to do when I have all these babies and that sort of thing, right? So that's what you have to deal with afterwards. Imagine never having seen that before. And, you know, chameleons, first off, they're really rare. It's not like, at that time, they were really rare. And, you know, to see little babies coming out of the egg, I mean, holy smokes, that was an intense, you know, that was like the best thing that ever happened to me at that point. It's like, holy cow, you know? So, yeah. And then once you get that bug, you're kind of hooked, right?
Yeah, totally. And I kind of imagine were the frilled lizards quite an investment at that time? Because, I mean, they're pretty expensive. I don't know what they were like back then, or you're getting wild caught in, or how did that work?
Yeah, they were... at that time, like I had sold a bunch of the baby veiled chameleons, and I had given some to Port Credit Pet Center, and that's a place out here near Toronto. And you know, I got one wild caught juvenile frilled dragon from them, and then I ordered another one from a company in the U.S. and actually I ordered two of them from that company in the U.S. So I had three animals. And And then part of the problem for me was, you know, I was late high school at this point, and now I'm going to university. What the heck do I do with these things, right? So my parents were nice enough. My dad was nice enough, because first year I lived in residence. My dad's like, I'll take care of them for the year. And, you know, we all know what that's like. If you have somebody looking after your stuff that's not too into it, they just kind of do the maintenance stuff. And nothing died, but they never reproduced or anything. And then, you know, and then after I finished my first year of university, and then I was able to get the frilled lizards into the house that we rented the second year. And then I was able to breed them and do that sort of thing. So, yeah, but back in that time, they were fairly expensive. I know I was selling, I think the veiled chameleons at the time were like $100 a piece I was selling them for. And I know I had to give up quite a few veiled chameleons to get the frilled lizards.
So. So let's bring us up to speed today. Now you have quite an operation at your place, and things have obviously changed. As you said, you eventually got into breeding ackies, and ever since that day, you're still continuously producing them, and you know you're working with many species now. So maybe you could list off just some of the species. We'll get into some more detail about them later. And then also, can you just tell us, for those who haven't seen your place, Dion did a great video doing a tour of your place on Reptiliatus. But for those that haven't seen, maybe describe the setup that you have for your animals.
Yeah. So right now, for the last 10 years or so now, I bought a farm, and it's actually zoned as farmland. So I actually registered it as a farm for breeding reptiles. And then I built a facility and totaled about 3,000 square feet. It's a two-story facility built into the side of a hill. So I have an upstairs and a downstairs, and that's where I do all breeding operations in there. And, you know, from the bugs I feed them to everything, right? To some road, like you name it, everything's kind of all contained in this building, separate from the house, which my wife is happy.
Yeah.
And, and then just the whole, you know, the whole shop is just enclosures that I've built. Every single one of them I've built, every you know, custom enclosure for all the monitors has been built by me. And yeah, just kind of laid out in rows in there and kind of optimized it over the years, I guess. Yeah.
And what's the quantity of animals? Do you have a kind of a rough number?
Ooh. Man, it's a tough question. I mean, of breeding animals, I probably, like, between monitors and geckos, you know, I probably have maybe 40 to 50 pairs of different breeding monitors, and, you know, maybe the same with the geckos, 40 to 50 pairs or so, you know, I could go probably bigger, but I like to do it predominantly myself. I mean, I do have a girl that helps me, but I find that if you get too big and you have too many tentacles and too many areas, that things suffer. So I kind of optimize with what I have, and also it's a lot of work. So the more you have, the more work it is.
But, well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, it looks like a tremendous amount of work. I mean, when you look at the place you have, it wouldn't be shocking if somebody thought that was your full-time job. And obviously that isn't your full-time job. For people that don't know, you're a school teacher. We talked about that when we had you on the live show. So you actually have a full-time job. So all I can imagine is that you have two full-time jobs.
Yeah, well, I have the reptile thing. That's why I have my employee Jocelyn. She's great. She does a lot of the routine things that saves hours of my day in there, and it lets me focus on more of the breeding aspect and, you know, the feedings and stuff, because that's where I interact with them. And she handles more of the mundane cleaning and watering and doing all that stuff. So that's been a godsend. And I'm a high school teacher, and I have a cottage rental business that I run too. So I have a bunch of rental properties I got to manage, and then two kids, one teenager and one that's just about to become a teenager. So, and all their stuff. So yeah, I don't know if I could go any bigger at this point, buddy.
Yeah. Well, it's probably good that you have a limit. I mean, it sounds like you must be cutting back on the sleep or something. I don't know how you do it all.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's like over the years you learn too. Like you go through these phases where when you're young and ambitious, like, oh man, that's so cool. I want that. And I want that. And I want that. And I want that. And then you end up looking around and like, I have so many different things from so many different genera. How the heck can I possibly look after them all properly? Right. Cause they're all so different. Right. So that's when I kind of really focused on, you know, the monitor lizards. That's what I really liked. And I was like, you know what, as a genus, they're similar, the housing and everything's similar. So I can do them all in the same shop, in the same scope with almost the same parameters. Right. And I've had lots of different monitor species. I've had every single Odatria that's been available, even some that you wouldn't find available now. And I've even narrowed those down to the ones that I just personally really like and have that kind of wow factor. And so I've even cut down the number of species that I work with to focus on the ones that that really, you know, I find that people like in general, and then I do obviously as well. So
yeah, obviously it's important to stay connected with things that you're passionate about. It makes it a lot easier to do the work. Do you plan like 10, 15 years down the road with that business, or do you just kind of take it one year at a time, and as long as you're still enjoying it, you still produce? Or do you think like, okay, maybe in 20 or 15 years, whenever you would retire from teaching, you want to do that full time? Do you plan that far?
Well, yeah, you know what? It's like one of those things. Like, I say this to my wife all the time. It's like, I can't picture a day going forward in my life where I'll ever get out of reptiles, right? This is something, it's not work for me, right? It's work in the aspect that I have to put in some time, but I enjoy it, right? I think that's what's going to keep me going into the future, is like, you know, a new exciting project or doing this and doing that. Like, you know, I can't ever see myself getting out of them. Now in the future, I do, when we retire, you want to travel and do this and that. So I might need some more help and put some more trust in people's hands, but yeah, I can't, you know, I've set myself up, like with the tree monitors specifically, I, you know, did a little bit of math and I figured out, okay, if I want to breed these things until, let's say I can actually physically breed them until I'm 80 years old, I'm 44 now, right? So in a monitor's lifespan, like a tree monitor's lifespan is or breeding span at the minimum might be 10 years, right? So, you know, I have 40 years or four generations from now until maybe the day I actually stop doing it at 80 or something. So I figure I need about four unique, distinct bloodlines or pairs of each species that I have, and then I can breed them from now until the day I probably will stop in, you know, my 80s or something, and then I don't have to inbreed. So I have planned that out into the future. So I planned it out even, you know, let's say Indonesia stopped export and I couldn't get any new bloodline. Now I have all set distinct bloodlines for the species that I'm working with. So I'm pretty much self-contained now in that respect. So I have planned it out with the hope that I will do this from now until, you know, God willing, until I can, right? I mean, or unless laws change or something changes where I'm unable to do it anymore. But yeah, that's the hope. Right.
Yeah, yeah. You do come across as somebody who is a planner and thinks about things, like, you know, as diligently as possible. You know, and you had mentioned before, last time we chatted, the amount of notes that you're taking all the time. So I can imagine that you're thinking down the road to make sure that the project is going to make sense.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, you know what? That's exactly it was with the, you know, the four distinct bloodlines of tree monitors and stuff. Like, I did the math, you know, a female might have a 10-year breeding life. And, you know, if I have to cross the lines that I have, how can I, you know, pyramid out until I get, you know, to the end destination of when maybe I don't do it anymore. Right. So that was all part of it. Part of it is too, like, I do suspect at some point in the future that export of wild collected animals won't be happening anymore, especially tree monitors are always on the radar in terms of, like, protection globally and stuff, which is good. I mean, I have no qualms about that. So, but yeah, so I've kind of anticipated these things with these trends and stuff like that, you know,
yeah,
planning so that I can at least stay self-contained, you know?
Well, so. I think that's a good practice for breeders of almost any species to just imagine that, let's say, just imagine fictionally 10 years down the road, whatever animal you're working with, you're not going to be able to get new genetics in. Every operation should attempt to set themselves up in a way that can be self-contained without having to default to massive inbreeding in order to continue to produce. Because we see it all the time in our trade that people inbreed like insane, especially when you bring in the morphs and whatnot, then it kind of gets exasperated in that sense. But even without that, people are so eager to breed that they just rather just inbreed to get a clutch or a litter rather than actually taking the time to think, what if down the road you actually can't get new genetics in and now you have completely bottlenecked everything you have?
Yeah, and that's, you know what, the reality is a lot of the species, depending on where they come from, have been bottlenecked in that way, right? If you think about Akis, bearded dragons for that fact, right? I mean, anything that originally came from Australia, there's only a handful of specimens that the original keepers got anyways. So genetically, there is no diversity there, right? So when people ask me about, oh, do you have a different bloodline of Kimberley Rock Monitor? It's like, well, I have tried to keep about as distantly related animals as I possibly could, right? But the reality is that probably all came from the same source initially, right? So, I mean, and I'm sure if you got them genetically tested, you'd see that, right? The guys in Europe are selling their Kimberley Rock monitors, which are the same lineage as mine. In fact, I've sold hundreds of them to Europe, right? So
yes, yeah.
They all have their same or. I mean, unless there's illegally acquired animals recently, right, due to smuggling or something, they're all going to be related, right? And unless it's a species that allows export, right, of wild collected individuals, you're going to get that bottleneck of genetics. So that's why with the tree monitors, I see what goes on with, like, Australia animals, because Australia doesn't let export anymore after, like, I think it was 1974, they shut it down. So with the tree monitors, that's why I was kind of really on a game plan to get distinct bloodlines so that, you know, in the future, if they did shut down export like Australia did, that I could say to customers with full confidence, yes, I have different bloodlines for you. Yeah. And when people ask me that for the Australian animals, I don't lie to them. I said, you know, the likelihood is that no, they're going to be somewhat related in some way, right? Now, the flip side of that is, okay, what does that mean? Like, what does inbreeding mean to a reptile? I mean, we've done it in dogs and cats for thousands of generations. And
yeah,
it has some adverse effects in certain breeds of dogs, but overall, it hasn't led to the mutants that people in society think that it does, right? So, you know, but obviously inbreeding's not ideal. Outcrossing is the best.
Yeah. So why don't we talk a little bit about how you got into the tree monitors? Because that is a very, you know, they're an incredibly interesting group of animals. I think they're the most eye-catching. People love to see the different colors and whatnot. So how did you first stumble across them, and then what made you take the plunge into, I think we could probably all imagine why you take the plunge to try to breed them, because it's just the type of person you are. But when did you come across them first?
I think I got my first blues 12 years ago. And it's not that I didn't have the opportunity to get them before. So all through the, you know, late 90s and early 2000s, up until 2012 or 24, whenever it was I got the blues, I was just Odatria. And part of my philosophy was, I don't want to compete with anything that comes in droves wild caught, right? Mm-hmm. If I'm going to put in the effort to breed them and spend the money in feeding them and housing them and doing all that stuff, it's a very tough pill to swallow when you're competing. You know, you want to sell them for a certain price to recoup, you know, the money you've invested into them, and you are competing with somebody that just imported a whole bunch of sickly animals from Indonesia. Because in my experience, you know, if a customer has to pay $500 more, like if you're talking tree monitors that are thousands of dollars each, right? You know, if somebody had to pay $2,500 from a pet store that imported one, or let's say $3,000 for a captive bred blue tree from me, you know, unfortunately, people always, you know, a lot of them will make that decision and go with the $500 cheaper one, but then they'll suffer the consequences, right? Of sickly animals, you know, a lot of times they die, all that sort of stuff, right? So that was the reason I didn't do it. And the blue trees kind of fell into my lap. I knew a person that had a pair of them, they had two Macrae in like a big Exoterra, like a 36x36 Exoterra. And they basically asked me if I wanted to try breeding them. They had two males and a female. And they're like, do you think you could breed these things? And I was confident that I could, but I just never wanted to get into them just for that reason, that they did come in wild caught. But I was like, this person offered me these ones. As a breeding loan, I'll try it. Right. So I set up one of the pairs, and I had the lone male off to the side. I set up the pair, and I was able to get them to breed, and I was able to get eggs from the female, but the female, I don't know how old she was, and she lay a couple eggs and they were infertile. And I was like, okay, so I'm getting the cycle ready, and I'm getting certain things dialed in, but I don't know about how old this female is, right? And then coincidentally, I was at a CRB expo, and I had a bunch of my monitors there, and just some guy randomly walks up to me and he says, how come you don't breed tree monitors? And I was like, well, I have a couple blues at home, seeing what I can do with them. And he says, he's like, I work at a PJ's pet center in Pickering, right? It's just in Ontario here. And he's like, I work at a PJ's pet center Pickering, and we've had this blue tree in the store for like 3 years. We got it as a baby and we raised it up the store. And he's like, nobody wants to buy it. The price is too high on it. And I was like, really? And me in the back of my mind thinking, what are the chances it's actually a female, right? Like, what are the chances of a female? It's probably a male or something. So I say, do you know anybody at the store that could shoot you some pictures of it right now while you're here at the show? Cause I didn't live too far from the PJs that he was talking about, like 15, 20 minute drive. I just never went in there at this point in my life, right? So I never saw it. I never went into the PJs. So he gets some pictures sent to him. He comes back to my table like a half hour. Like, he took some pictures. I look at this thing. I'm like, oh man, I think that's a female, right? So sure enough, the expo ended on the Sunday. I drove to the PJs on the Monday, and I looked it over and I was like, yeah, that's a female. And it's in pretty good shape for a pet store animal. They had a ridiculous price tag on it, right? It was probably like, at the time, you know, I think imported blue trees were coming in. You could buy them for like $900 or something. And they were asking like $3,500 for this this importer thing. So I said, I just made him a deal. I said, hey, why don't I give you a whole bunch of animals that you can actually sell, like some geckos and ball pythons, and I'll trade you for this blue tree. So it worked out. And so I got this thing, and the rest is history, man. That female was good. I think within 3 months, she laid me a clutch of 5 eggs. And then ever since that time, I've been getting 5 eggs every 3 months from that girl. And that was, 12 years ago that started.
Wow.
And then, and to be quite honest, I found them easier to breed than like the Kimberley Rock monitors, in terms of like hatching the eggs and stuff like that. So I had had, I had seen people in the past try and breed blues and kill babies and eggs. And I had tried to get a pair from a guy that was getting eggs, but he couldn't hatch them and he never coughed them up. But I was confident. I was like, I know what I'm doing with the Kims, and people experience the same problems that they have with Kimberley eggs as they do with these tree monitor eggs. And I had the Kimberleys dialed in at that point. So I was like, I'm confident I could do the blues. The first clutch, 5 eggs, hatched them all, and the rest is history. They were great. And then from there, I was like, okay, now let's try greens. I've had success with the blues. Let's try greens. Let's try the different colors. And then, coincidentally, in that trajectory of me really kind of starting to focus on tree monitors, the availability of them from Indonesia started to buckle down, and the numbers of imports start to really diminish, which as a breeder, that's great for me, right? Unless I wanted to acquire more animals, that became a challenge trying to find some new bloodlines. But in terms of, the demand for my offspring, that shot it up, right? Mm-hmm. So to where we are today. And, if you see an imported tree monitor come into Canada, you're pretty damn lucky, right? Like, you never see them come in anymore. Twofold. It's good for the wild populations, and from a breeder's perspective, now I have the collection that I want. It's good that I don't have to compete with those as much. So,
yeah. Well, yeah. And it's tough to motivate breeders to want to breed if there are giant droves of wild caught coming in. Like you said, it's an issue on both sides. The buyer is going to gravitate towards the cheaper animal, and the breeder is not going to want to take the time to actually tinker with the species to figure it out. So what was the issue with the eggs? I know you had told me before, but now I'm forgetting. People were getting good eggs, but they weren't hatching, or the animals were dying in the shell. And so what was it that you learned from the Kims that worked so well with the monitors or with the blues?
Yeah, it's just, people have this notion that, you got to mix a 1-to-1 ratio of water to perlite and do all this. Basically it just led to the point where people were just drowning the embryos in the egg because the eggs were just too overhydrated, right? And I'm not sure how that leads to the baby not being able to hatch, whether it's just the pressure inside the egg. And you'd hear of people, they open their incubator and then they open the egg box, and the pressure inside the egg is so great that the egg actually bursts open, right? Wow. That was a thing too. So I lost a Kimberley clutch or two in the infancy of figuring that out. But, then I just realized I had to dial back the water. I always erred on the side of being drier than wetter, because it's easier to add water to the mixture than it is to try and take it away, right? So, and that's what I would do. And I went through stage where I'd have my incubation container with the eggs, and you kind of see what an overhydrated or inflated egg looks like, and then like, okay, I need to dry this out a bit. So you'd poke some extra holes in, and then if it started to dimple, I would actually take those eggs out and put them in a slightly wetter medium in a different container, let them fill back out, then move them back. Like, I was always playing with these things until I kind of got it dialed in, and now I'm at a point where I can roughly eyeball the water that goes in. Like, I still measure out grams wise what goes in to my mixture, and then it's pretty good now. I don't have to tinker too much with the eggs. The only variable is the number of eggs you have in the incubator, right? Because the more egg boxes and medium you have in there, the more relative humidity goes up. So, if you have a lot of eggs in there, you're barely putting any water in the substrate, right? Whereas if you have one clutch in the incubator, you better make it a bit wetter. So there's those variables, right? That's why when people ask me about egg incubation, I can't give you a particular recipe for your situation specifically, right? And that's why I always tell people, you got to look at the eggs. If they look like a swollen ping pong ball, that's not good. They should be nicely you know, elliptical in shape, right?
Yeah, that's one of there's what to me what you're describing is kind of like the art of doing what you're doing. And quite often I think people get stuck on the science side, which means, you know, they're just trying to follow exactly what somebody told them to do, whether it's on a forum or on Facebook, and they're trying to follow these exact steps, and then they're actually ignoring the visual evidence they have in front of them in order to make the right call. But so instead of just trying to follow common sense and learning how to do things by feel, they're just getting stuck on the instruction manual that they were given, and you know, it all pretty much always ends up in disaster because you're not learning the process of making a successful hatch.
Yeah, all the care sheets and stuff. I mean, it's great that people put them out there, and it's just a general foundation of knowledge, but everybody's situation is different. Like my incubator here in Ontario in July, when it's humid, I'm going to have to monitor those eggs and do things differently than if I lived in Calgary in January where it's bone dry, right? Mm-hmm. So there's you know, a lot of factors, and that's why the best thing to do, and I can say this because I've seen lots of eggs, but it's hard for somebody who hasn't, and I get that. You know, you have to look at the eggs and see what the egg actually looks like. That's one of the things I when I get my new website up and running here, I'll show pictures like overhydrated egg, perfect egg. You know what I mean, right?
Yes,
like you
want
that egg to have a nice shape, but to not have any dimples in it. But you don't want it like if it looks like a ping pong ball and it's all round, that's way too wet, right? Yeah. It needs to be that like elliptical shape. So I plan to do like a, you know, good egg check mark. This is bad, right? So, but yeah, you just have to play with it. Yeah.
If you are interested in supporting the podcast and simultaneously supporting the welfare of your reptile at home, make sure you check out Custom Reptile Habitats for their premium enclosures. You can find an affiliate link in both the YouTube description or the show notes, or just head to animalsathome.ca/CRH. If you use that link and head to their website to make a purchase, a commission comes back to me at no extra cost to you. And of course, that helps me support the show. Alternatively, you can join us over on Patreon at patreon.com/animalsathome. At home. For as little as 75 cents per episode, you can support the podcast and you will automatically be entered into the Discord server so you can have conversations with like-minded keepers. If you do bump yourself up to the $5 per month tier, you will have early access to episodes and the opportunity to submit questions to upcoming guests. So you had success with the blues, you had success with the greens, and yeah. Do you have four species that you're working with the tree monitors now, or how many?
Six.
Oh, it's six. So it's a blues, greens, yellows, blacks.
The cordensis and the bomii.
Okay. Those ones, yeah. I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, they're kind of the outliers, right? The common ones that everybody knows about that have been available for the last 20 years and imported shipments and stuff have been, you know, blues, yellows, greens, and blacks, right? And that was the big four that I initially tried to get and breed. And, you know, and then... You know, I've successfully bred all those species. And then it was like, okay, well, there's still a couple outliers that I don't have, but they never came into Canada. Like they have never come into Canada, except for now that I know what I'm doing with import and export, and I have good connections in Europe and Indonesia, you know, I've been able to get a couple animals, you know, from people. So I've been able to source these different pieces to finish the, you know, the six monitor tree monitor puzzle, right? Or the six species tree monitor puzzle. So
how different are they? Obviously the color is strikingly different. They're all very different that ways, but their body shape and plan looks extremely similar. I mean, besides seeing the babies that you had at your table at the expo, I've not seen adults. So are there some size differences or behavior differences that you notice amongst the species?
It's kind of a tough question because you will hear people say that Macrae are bigger than Piscinus and that Bacari are, you know, bigger than, you know, Risingeri or whatever. In my experience, and now I've had a lot of animals and I've bred a lot and I have quite a vast collection, the overall body size is fairly comparable among all the species, with the exception of the cordensis. The cordensis seem much smaller, right? So Like, I have a female cordensis in my care now that bred, and she, you know, when she was breeding and laying eggs, she started laying eggs at like 175 grams. And she was already 5 years old when I got her. Whereas something like a female Macrae, you know, I won't usually breed those until they're about 300 grams. So that's the one exception. And then I do have out of... it's even tough. Males are generally bigger than females, obviously, but like I have big males of every color tree monitor. Like I have a massive male Macrae, which are the blues. I have a massive male black. I have a massive male green. In fact, that male green probably rivals all of the other ones. So for me, I don't know if there's much difference between the overall size on average, because from what I've seen and all the animals that I've seen, you know, there's nothing to really, no real evidence of that, you know, unless I have small Macrae relative to my, mm-hmm. you know, to my greens. So the only real noticeable one would be the cordensis seem much smaller. And, you know, it seems like every male Macrae I have is pretty damn big. So, whereas I have a couple male black trees, the Beccari, that are a bit smaller, but you know, you'd have to really analyze hundreds of animals to get a true estimate. You know, you hear people say, oh, Macrae are huge. Well, is it just the one that you had, or how many have you seen? Right. So, you know, I have like seven or eight female Macrae in my possession right now. Ones that are either wild caught or that I've raised up myself and you know, that's just females, seven or eight females. And then I have, you know, another four or five males. I'm not breeding all those females. I just have a few in standby or whatever, but, mm-hmm. but yeah, it seems pretty standard. And these are all different bloodlines too, right? So it's not like it's just a small bloodline or a big bloodline. I mean, there's some variety in the ones that I have, but I have heard of guy, like I know a guy in the US that has a pair, and his female Macrae, that's a blue, she just laid like 9 eggs, and on average I get 5 per clutch. Wow. She laid 9 eggs, and he's telling me the weight of his female. I'm like, oh my god, those things are giant, right? So who knows? And then diet plays a huge part in that, right? You can get a monitor lizard real big if you feed it a real rich diet. Doesn't mean it'll live long. I'm not saying that guy is like that, but you know, I've seen people, like I have yellow ackies, I've bred yellow ackies for a long time, and my yellow ackies, to me, they have a standard size. I feed them a variety of diet, mostly bugs and whatever. But I mean, I remember selling some of my own babies to a guy, and he showed me his ackies like 2 years later, and they were, honest to God, the size of these yellow ackies, double the size of adults, right? And I was like, holy smokes, like, what the heck are you feeding these things? Because they're related, right? They're the same bloodline, same genetics. And he's like, oh, I just feed them superworms. I don't want to deal with crickets. And I was like, oh, that explains it. I mean, they were fat, but they were also really big and long. I was like, wow. But they never, ever bred for them. Yeah. So, yeah. So there's so many factors in the size of it. But I'd say they're, you know, I think they're all roughly the same size, you know.
And then behavior-wise, do you find that they're very similar?
Yeah. Again, they're super smart. They're super individual. So you get some that are like, oh, I'll run out on your shoulder and play with you. And then you'll get some that you slide the glass open and they run behind the bark. Right. Mm-hmm. And that goes for whether it's wild caught or captive bred. I have some captive bred ones that don't like being around me. And I have, you know, some wild caught ones that, you know, will jump on my shoulder. So on average, I think, you know what, Beccari, the black trees, they start out really shy, but I think they're almost the most personable of the species that I have. Like, they're always social. They always come out. They always eat from toms. They always want to jump on your head. Like, they're really cool. Greens, you know, I have a buddy who has a breeding pair of greens, and his are super social, just like my black trees are. The greens that I have, you know, the ones that I have, I wouldn't say they're overly social. They'll eat from tongs and stuff like that. But, you know, the offspring from those ones, you know, one of them is one that I sold to die on there. And that's the Sabzi. And that thing, like, you know, it plays card games with them pretty much, yeah, right? Yeah. So, you know, it's all what you put into it and the individual personality. Yeah, so I think you'd probably have to do like an analysis of, a bunch of captive bred specimens. So you start all with that same control, and you have like 10 blues, 10 blacks, 10 greens, and then really treat them all the same way to see how their personalities come out, right?
It answered like a true scientifically minded person.
It's really hard to say. That's when people say these things, I always, I don't usually vocalize it, but in the back of my mind, I'm like, okay, is that just the one that you have or whatever, right?
Are people, and I'm not advocating for this, I'm just wondering because they must be fairly closely related as a species. Do people hybridize them at all?
Oh, I've seen some hybrids made. I personally wouldn't. I don't see any value in it, right?
Yeah, me either. I just imagine you could. I see people doing these weird things all the time, and with a species like that, which are so close together, you can imagine that people are doing it.
Yeah, I've seen a few hybrids that people have created, right? Usually it falls in like, people have a female of one type and a male of the other, and they can't find the opposing sex of either species. Like, oh, what do I do? And they hybridize, right? And the hybrids that I've seen, they never look as good as either of the original species, right? Now they haven't hybridized all the different possibilities, but I think I've seen a blue tree and a cordensis cross, and I've seen a black and a green, and they weren't anything special. And then you really muddy the waters, right? So,
Totally, yeah.
but you know what? They're extremely similar. I mean, honestly, I when did they evolve as a different species? Like, I don't know. I want to say around the last ice age ending, right? So you're not talking a very long period of time. Sea levels rose, isolated them on Indonesian little islands, and they evolved along different pathways for the last 20,000 years. And that in the evolutionary scope of things, that's nothing, right? They were all probably one species. They were all one species at the same time, and
For
then whatever
sure.
evolutionary pressure was on their island that drove them to evolve the different colors. That's where we're at now. But I mean, they're the same monitor, in my opinion. They're all the same monitor, just with different paint jobs.
And that's the fascinating part is how different their color actually is when you have something as, bright and vibrant as a yellow or a green to something as dark as the Beccaria, the black. And the fact that they come from relatively close geologically, there's not a huge, you can't imagine there being a massive difference between the evolutionary pressures, but obviously there must be. Have you spent time thinking about what some of those pressures might be to generate the different colors?
I mean, you could only speculate, right? Like something like the blue tree monitors. In terms of a land animal having a blue coloration, very, very rare, right? More common in birds than anything else, but reptiles, blue coloration is a pretty rare thing. Obviously, in any other, kingdom of animal, they're it's really, really rare, except for fish, right? You see more blue fish than anything. So what would drive a blue tree monitor to become blue? Buddy, I have no idea what that pressure was, right? I have no idea. So I can't even speculate, to be honest.
Yeah, it's
Like
so fascinating.
the black tree monitors, usually black reptiles, ones that are all black, they've evolved a black coloration because they need to absorb as much heat energy as possible from the sun, right? So either they're at high altitudes or they're from a cooler climate and all of those good things, right? So that was my thought on the black trees initially, right? I'm like, what does Aru look like? What's the elevation that you find black tree monitors at? And I've asked some people that actually go out and collect, and they're like, oh no, it's the same as everything else. Like literally, I've tried to find information on this, right? Where they're from, is their temperature different? You look at all the climate data, they're all the same, right? So the black trees, I experimented with keeping them cooler. And I actually seem to stir on breeding. So there might be something to the black ones being black because they're from, maybe a cooler area. Maybe the island of Aru gets different ocean currents than the other side of Indonesia. You never know. I to be honest, I couldn't even come up with an educated guess as to why, you have a green and a yellow and a blue and, who knows.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Anyway, and husbandry wise, is there things that you've had them now for, let's say, 12-ish years? You've been working with them, breeding them very successfully. Are there things care wise that you've changed over the years, and some like maybe mistakes that you maybe have made, or adjustments you've made that's giving you the success and the health that you have in your clutch or your collection?
Some of the mistakes I made early on with the treat monitors was probably treating them like the Australian stuff. Like the Australian stuff, you really got to cook, you know? They like it really hot. Tree monitors, they don't like it so hot. So you adjust the temperature a little bit on that front. But I think by the time I started with the blue trees, I was pretty dialed into like just monitor husbandry in general. And the reality is like, The Kimberleys and Ackies and Pilbaras I keep in a particular way. And the tree monitors I keep pretty much the exact same way, just in a taller enclosure, right? Mm-hmm. Substrates all the same, nest boxes. You know, I have more branches and cork tiles on the walls for the tree monitor enclosures and stuff like that. But, you know, other than that, the general monitor blueprint of the cage is the same, or the enclosure, it's the same. Right. So the lighting is all the same for all the species that I work with in terms of like the UV light and the spotlight. And it's just, yeah, it's like really there's nothing particular. I don't use any mist systems or anything like that.
So do you mist everything by hand or do you not mist?
I do mist. I mist everything by hand. I'll spray everything. I'll give everything a little bit of a rainfall every second day. If it's a pair of tree monitors that's coming into cycling and I have it all mapped out. So they lay eggs every 3 months, roughly, like a pair that's going well every 3 months. So I know that, you know, a female lays eggs on this day, 2 months after that day, she'll be starting to cycle again, right? So, you know, when I know she's starting to cycle, then I'll spray them every day, right? To kind of stimulate the rain period. Whether that does anything or not, I don't necessarily think it does for them, but it's just a what if. If it does, at least I'm doing it, right? But yeah, I missed them by hand. It's part of it is the interaction with the animals, right? I find if everything's automated, then I miss out on key observations, right?
Yeah.
So I like to go in there and spray because the animals like it. They come out, they drink from the hose, and, you know, you get to look over the animals. You get to see, make sure they're okay and all that. And then the same with the feeding, right? The feedings, I do all the feedings because they come out. I get a good look at them. You know, are they hunting properly? Or are they listless, lethargic? Like, that's all part of it for me. So I don't really like the automated foggers and misters and all of that stuff. I mean, that's part of the joy of having them. I don't want somebody to do that for me, to be honest, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a good point.
And those observations, like some of the things you notice when you're doing those, what seem like mundane tasks that you don't want to do, like that's where a lot of the learning comes in, right? Because you really get to know the animals when you do those things. I'm really hands-on with that. And the other thing is too, right? I can physically go in, observe the enclosure and look at it and be like, oh, is it too wet in here? Is it too dry? Like, how much do I need to mist it, right? If you have a mister that comes on 3 times a day, it doesn't know. It's just dumping water to the enclosure. It could be super wet, whatever. So, and that's, you know, contrary to popular belief, tree monitors do not like to be wet, right? They'll swim, you know, in a little pond if you give them that. But, I mean, they get rain every day in Indonesia, you know, at a certain period of time in the day, but their environment does not stay wet. That rain dries out really quick, absorbs into the ground. And if you saw the terrain on Batanta, where blue trees are from, pretty damn dry, you know, from pictures and stuff. So, rainforest animals are not, you know, and I learned this a long time ago with things like emerald tree boas, right? It's like, people were doing, they think, oh, it's going to be soaking wet water, super hot, super humid. And that was everything wrong that people were doing.
And the fogging. Remember the fogging with emerald tree boas? It's just like, it looks like a nightclub and the thing's like, I'm dying.
Yeah, that's right. So I don't do any of that. I err on the cautionary side of dry. Part of the problem is like, you can have a very wet environment in a rainforest, right, that amphibians really like and stuff, like the Costa Rican jungle, let's say. But you have to remember, there's pretty good airflow there. If you're trying to replicate that in a wooden box, let's say, you're not going to get the airflow that will allow that to, you know, at least remain partially sterile, right? If you're air and you're wet all the time, you're going to have problems. You're going to have skin rot. You're going to have toes falling off. You're going to have all sorts of issues. So I like to keep them dry. And you can look at the monitor too and say, okay, does this thing need a misting, right? This, you know, you can look at it physically, observe. I'll spray you today. You know, you look a little bit dry or whatever. So, and that recipe seemed to work well for me.
And you offer water dishes as well.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's a given, right? There's always a big water dish in there. The water dish is actually big enough where they can kind of go and sit in it if they want to, right? In fact, females that just have laid a clutch of eggs, that's their MO. They will come out of the nest box and they will go in there. I have a hanging cup holder, right? I have deep deli cups for the water. They'll like go in there and submerge and like cuddle up like a jacuzzi, you know, after a hard day of egg laying, right? That's what they do. So that's one of the indicators where it's like, oh, she must have laid because the water bowl spilled oil, right?
Yeah, that's awesome. Do you house everything individually pretty much? Is there any cohabbing for those group of species?
When I grow things up and I'm raising them, I raise every single animal individually. That way I know exactly who's eating, how they're doing, and there's no unforeseen stresses from cage mates and all that stuff, right? So, but then when they become sexually mature and there's something that I'm going to put into a breeding program, then I'll put them with a male. And or like a females and males together, let's say, and then I'll leave them together. And the only time I will remove the males is when I know the female's about to lay eggs, because in tree monitors, even in Kimberley rock monitors, you know, monitors are egg eaters, right? So if you have a male in there that has a fresh clutch, he'll try and eat them. So I'll pull the males out and I'll put the males in separate enclosures. And I'll let the female, I'll give her peace, and she, you know, she'll lay her eggs about a week or so after I pull that male out. And then I usually give her about a month after egg laying or so to just be alone, recoup some body weight, energy reserves, and then I'll put the male back in there so that he's ready for the next cycle when she's ready to go again. Sometimes I'm forced to keep the males out because females, especially recently, I don't know what it is that I've changed, but that has caused this, but I've had a lot of females that are really, really protective of their nests. Even after I go in there and I'll remove the eggs, you know, it could be a month after, I'll go to put the male in, and man, those females are just trying to chase those males around. And like the males are scared. I mean, they run. So, okay, I'll pull the male out. I'll give her another couple of weeks. I'll try again. Right. Usually about after a month, month and a half, they're good. But I have one pair, this one yellow tree female, man, she does not like, she used to be great. I don't know what changed, but she just does not like that male in there. So I like with her, she's almost alone all the time. And I just look for her to start showing signs of cycling. She gets a bit hippie and bulky. And I'm like, okay, I better put the male in now. I'm like, you ready, buddy? Here you go.
Good luck.
Yeah. And I'm pretty good with timing that stuff on them. So within about a week, he gets the job done. And then he's like, get me the hell out of here.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, everything else, all the Odatria, the pairs are just kept together. You know, but I never raise them together. I think that's one of the critical things that people do wrong is they'll buy like three Ackies and they'll raise them all together, right? Because there's all this misinformation about them sexing themselves in groups and all this stuff, which is utter nonsense. And it ends up leading to nothing but problems. So I raise everything individually for that reason.
Yeah. Now, for the tree monitors, is there any common like health issues or illnesses or anything that you've had pop up over the years that you've kind of figured out how to deal with it, or have you had pretty much a stable, healthy population?
Let me think. Some of the things that can occur are obesity in them, right? So they're, you know, the general rule of thumb is feed them insects mostly, right? Crickets, not too many worms, but you can feed them worms of various sorts. People are, you know, now that you can get disco roaches, they love cockroaches and, you know, a variety of bugs. People have feed them quail, day-old quail chicks and stuff, and you can feed them rodents. Like I feed mine rodents once a week, like a fuzzy mouse or two for females. But females, the mice, because they're reproductively active and they're burning lots of energy, right? And they need to build up their fat. So I tend not to feed males mice too much, right? The odd treat once a month or something like that. They'll get it because they love them. So you have to watch out for obesity. But even then, I think if you have a reproductive female, it's pretty hard to get her fat, you know, if she's cycling and laying eggs. So that's one thing. I haven't seen it with mine because I tend to know what I'm doing with the diet of them for the most part. So I can see, okay, you're getting a little too plump or you're too skinny and adjust the diet that way. The tree monitors, they seem a bit sensitive to like skin things that happen. I've heard lots of accounts of like fungus on skin or bacterial infections or things like that. But they're all like treatable things. And I think a lot of times that has to actually do with the enclosures that people have being too wet, right? If you have a lot of moisture and warmth and stale air, well, you're going to get fungal infections and bacterial infections. It's that simple. So I've seen it once, and actually I've seen it once with a yellow tree that I actually had imported, and it came to me and it looked totally normal, but I have a quarantine room. I actually have the only lizards I have in my house separate from my reptile building are my quarantine area in the basement, right? So I have several enclosures set up in the quarantine area, and this thing, it looked beautiful, man, when I got it. It was nicely colored and everything, and then it was in the quarantine area, clean sterile enclosure, but it was carrying something, right? And it started to get this like scale rot on the back, or I don't even know what it was. I thought initially it was a fungal infection, so I tried treating it as such, didn't really do too much, and then I ended up treating it with like a betadine bath and then putting an antibiotic cream on it, and it cleared up the infection and it went away. But those are like some of the little nuances, you know. And I usually quarantine like wild collected animals for like 6 months, right? Mm-hmm. And good thing I do, because this infection, it was whatever it was dormant for the first 2 to 3 months that I had this animal. And then it just slowly started cropping up. I could see like a little bubble in the scales. I'm like, what's going on? You know, I didn't think much of it. And then, you know, one day you wake up and it's like, oh, it's a really big kind of blister. And I'm like, oh, geez, what is this? Right. So, you know, the number one thing was to give it the iodine or betadine bath, because that stuff kills any parasite, fungus, right? And that stuff's easy to come by. And then you can look at it and treat it with, you know, an antifungal or an antibiotic, depending on what you need to do. But there are things like that. Monitors can lose toes and claws because they can't shed their skin properly if things are kept too wet, right? That's another common misconception, is that people, you know, they think that their monitor lizard is having trouble shedding its, you know, toe skin because it's too dry, and it's exactly the opposite, right? This monitor skin needs to be a bit dry so that it can flake off, right? If it can't flake off, then it forms constricted bands around their fingers and claws, and as the lizard grows, that doesn't grow with it because it's dead skin that hasn't sloughed off, and it forms like a tourniquet, and their claws and stuff fall off. So
that's an interesting point. I mean, and they're so active with their hands, basically, right, that they're going to, that dry skin is going to flake off as they pass through bark and dig through things. So it kind of naturally will just rip apart and come off if it is dry enough.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest misconceptions that people still have to this day, is like they see their lizard shedding and they spray it. They want to spray the crap out of it. And like, oh, it's losing its claws and it's not shedding. Well, you're spraying it too much. You got to let it dry, right? I've seen ackies that people have got from Europe, you know, on orders that have come in with layers and layers of shed on their tail, and it's just because they've been horribly wet and humid conditions, right? So like I said, we can't mimic the airflow in our enclosures that animals in the wild get, so you can't rain on them as much. It's that simple, right? So
yeah.
Yeah.
You see that with snakes too. People will, when the animal starts to go into shed, they just start squirting it with water, where usually the bad shed is often due to dehydration and not due to the fact that there's a humidity issue. You know, if the animal hasn't been drinking water, then you might have an issue with, you know, actually shedding the skin, but spraying it with water during the shed cycle itself is probably going to do nothing for it besides maybe bug it.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Snakes are, snake shedding. Like, I used to have snakes and stuff, and I would do the same thing, right? Oh, my snake is about to shed. I better make sure it has a humid environment. And because snakes shed their skin in one continuous, shed, I think it's probably beneficial that they have the humidity, right? It's like the dry snakes. That's where it starts cracking, because there you need their skin to be pliable to come off in one big sheet. Whereas the lizards, there's flake off in patches, right?
Right.
You don't want it to be one big sheet because they don't shed in the same way that a snake does, right? So and I think maybe that misconception does come from snake husbandry, where you have to hose them down, right? So they need some humidity, right? But they need to be able to get away from the humidity, like the monitors. Yeah, if they can't get away from the wetness, then you're just going to have problems, right? So
yeah, absolutely. Now what about the color? Like, obviously, they have incredibly vibrant color, and I know this is pretty common across many different species of reptiles that we keep, is in captivity, you start seeing kind of a muted version of what you might see in the wild. Do you experience sort of a decrease in vibrancy or color with the tree monitors? And if you don't, is there something that you're doing that you think is kind of keeping it more of a wild look?
It's hard to say, because I think, you know, to get a real grasp on that, you have to be like very multi-generational in your production, right? You have to have the standard from what it was when it was wild caught to, you know, 5, 6, 7 generations out. What does it look like? Right.
Right.
One, the color is individual on them, especially things like yellow tree monitors, right? I mean, you get a whole spectrum of imported animals coming in. Some of them look green. Some of them look ridiculously yellow right off the boat. That's with a total wild diet, right? So whether it's an age thing, you know, our younger monitors are generally more vibrant than older ones just to begin with. So that could be it. Monitor lizards, they all go through this stage in their life where their colors are just insane regardless, especially with things like red ackies, pilbaras, Camberleys, and I'd imagine it's the same thing with the tree monitors from what I've seen. So there's that aspect of it. In my collection I have with yellow tree monitors, I'll use those as an example, because people always ask about, oh, that one, you know, yellows often seem green to me, why are they called yellows, right? So I've seen a lot of imported animals, and I've done my best to pick the most yellow specimens fresh off the boat possible. And I have some like incredible breeding pairs of yellows, and they throw some incredible looking babies. The first yellows that I ever bred were imports as well. And they were, you know, they were nice yellows, and their babies are nice as well. And I have this one particular baby from that pair that's like screaming yellow. So part of it is just the variability within the species, I think. The other part is like having good UV lighting, and then diet, right? The diet that you feed them is going to work wonders on their color, right? So like the feeder insects, they get better food than I do. They're you know, they're so well fed. You know, so I try and cover the spectrum of nutrition through the bugs. And, you know, every time I feed, before I feed those insects something, like I'll, before work in the morning, I'll feed my feeders like a whole array of vegetables and fruits and different things. And then when I get home from work, they're all fat and gut loaded up, those crickets and worms. And then I start feeding them to all the monitors, right? So there's that end of it too. So, and then you can feed them different foods that will enhance certain colors, right? Like I talked to a guy that had a pair of Kimberley Rock monitors, and he's like, my Kimberley Rock monitors love shrimp. And I'm like, oh, really? Shrimp. And he's like, you won't believe how red they are. And he showed me pictures of how red his Kimberley rock monitors were. I was like, holy smokes, they're like flamingos, right? So, you know, a lot of what you feed them will translate into color, right? That's the premise of like the, you know, a lot of the ractinaculous diets, right? They have like color enhancing diets for like crested geckos and things like that. So, you know, that's part of it. A good diet will definitely enhance the color of your lizards.
Sure. Yeah, that definitely makes sense. Now, I'm curious about this because obviously you're incredible what you're doing. You're having success breeding these animals, and there's an interest factor from your own self just in being interested in producing tree monitors. But there's also the side that now you have to sell these animals, and they are... they're a more advanced species than, you know, the leopard geckos and the bearded dragons. So when somebody does, you know, they come with a price tag as well. So hopefully that kind of weeds people out. But do you ever wonder, like, do you ever think about producing animals that do require such a high level of care, or that require a keeper to be in tune with what they're doing, or turned on? Just because, you know, we see animals end up in the wrong hands all the time. I just wonder if you ever spend time thinking about that.
Oh yeah, 100%, right? Like you said, the price tag usually weeds out the impulse buyers. So that's good. And generally it's a process. When customers come to me, they're blank slates. They want to know the size enclosure. They have all sorts of ideas about what they want to do. They want to do really well by the lizards. So that's always good. Like every customer that I've ever sold to, it's not like they're throwing these things into a 10-gallon aquarium, right?
Yeah.
They're like, okay, I built this, you know, this huge thing. There's plants everywhere. And so they already have the right mindset to do well with it. Like they know that it's a difficult, you know, somewhat difficult, or, you know, it's going to require some care and maintenance, not just a throwaway pet here. So yeah, that usually I can tell by talking to somebody that they're on the right track. And most of the time, somebody looking for something like a blue tree monitor, they know what they're getting into, you know, just because they've already done a ton of background research. And I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, if you read anything about blue tree monitors online, it already puts you on your heels thinking, oh man, I don't even know if I want to do these because it sounds so difficult. But the reality is, there's a vulnerable stage after they hatch where, you know, if you don't do things right with babies and you have them housed together and you don't pick up on some subtle things, that they can be difficult. But once they're past that, like two month mark, I mean, they're honestly bulletproof. They're like an Aki, really. I mean, you just, you know, have water available, feed them a varied diet, have the correct temperatures, and they'll do well in anything, honestly, right? Like the babies, I just put them in a standard enclosure that I would use for any other monitor lizard that I breed, right? It's like a 3 foot long by 18 inch tall by 2 feet deep for individual babies. And the tree monitors will even use a rock stack, like the baby trees, right? So, you know, I don't overthink it. It's like, are the temperatures correct? Are they eating? Do they have a place to hide? Do they have a place to get a little humid if they want to? As long as those things are met, they're really bulletproof. So I'm not really worried about that. If the customer has if the person has the right mindset and they're like, okay, my temperature is this and this and this and this, and they show me a picture of their enclosure, I'm like, yeah, you're going to be fine with this thing, right?
Yeah,
and I'm keeping them for a long time anyways. So they're forgiving. I mean, if somebody makes a mistake, their lizard isn't super vulnerable, right?
Yeah. And I guess, like you said, the price tag definitely tells you the commitment level of that person that's wanting to buy. You're not going to have someone walk past your table at an expo and say, wow, that's a blue lizard. I'm going to go home with that today. And I mean, I'm sure you wouldn't sell them to that person anyway, but it does kind of shield it from that.
Yeah, no, when I bring a tree monitor to an expo, it's usually for display, right?
Yeah.
And nobody goes to an expo wanting to spend that kind of money, usually on a lizard. And lizards are like, oh, okay, I don't have an enclosure or anything for it. I'll just drop this money on this and keep it in a shoebox while I build something, right? It's always a, holy smokes, that thing is amazing. Do you have more available? When will you have the next ones? I'm like, well, you can put a deposit on one of these ones if you want. Go get all set up. I'll help you out, right? Most of these people that see me at the shows, I mean, I've received messages from them. There's been always like a slow trickle of interest until they finally okay, I want to do this now. Like, I think I'm ready, right? It's always like that. It's not like somebody walking through the expo and they see a leopard gecko for $40. I'm like, yeah, I can buy this. $40, who cares, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, like you said, you don't have like deli cups of monitors at the expo. Maybe as we wrap up here, you could just let us know. You've listed some of the other monitor species you keep and breed as well, but you also have some geckos, and I forget if you've mentioned them. So maybe you could also mention some of the other actual outside of the monitor world that you keep, and that, you know, if someone were to go to an expo in Canada, they would see that on your table.
Yeah, so I breed the Lychianus as well. The racket or the Monaro gecko, Chahua, gargoyle geckos. So I have the New Caledonian realm, because they're interesting, but they're really easy to keep. They don't take a lot of attention. So I have a few enclosures with those. And then I do work with a lot of the different Australian knobtail species. So, you know, the Levis, the Levis pilbarensis, albinos, the Stellatus, Wheeleri cinctus, Amii. So I have the whole realm of Australian knobtails. For some reason, they're not a huge seller in Canada. I think they're the coolest damn gecko you can get. But they just look like these little Pokemons with these giant eyes and these giant heads and all the little quirks about them. But, you know, maybe they'll pick up in popularity. But I sell most of those things to Europe and Asia. But I love them, so I keep working with them.
Yeah, and you never know. Tides will change. They are a really neat species. And actually, last year I was really looking to wanting to get into something, and that was on my list of like a potential option of something, because you don't see them a lot, especially in Manitoba. You don't see them a lot, and they are, like you said, you look at them and you think, oh, that doesn't even look real, the way their eyes are shaped, and yeah, they're interesting.
I think that's part of the problem with some of these species is like, you know, for the majority of Canada, they're not coming to the Toronto Reptile Expo to see them in person, right? But when people see them in person at my table, they're generally blown away, like, oh my God, that thing is amazing, right? Yeah. And those are the people that actually see them in person. They're the ones that come back, like, okay, I really want that thing. Like, they'll have taken a picture of it at the expo. Do you have any of these? And they'll send me the picture back. I'm like, yeah, I got some of those. Yeah. So, but it's one of those things, right? It's like, unless you, when you see it in person, then it really blows you away, right? Because pictures don't often do them justice, because you don't get a grasp of the size and all of that stuff, right? Like,
yeah,
you
know, totally.
Amii, like a Nephrus Amii. I mean, that gecko is the size of, you know, a guinea pig almost. It's huge, right? not a guinea pig, but like, you know, it's a big, robust gecko. And when people see them in person, like, wow, that's a wicked looking gecko, right? So, yeah.
Well, you are someone who has an incredible amount of information in your head. And, you know, we already alluded to the fact that you're obviously a detailed note taker. And you did mention, and I know you mentioned it last time you were on, that your website is outdated and it's, you know, you're working on, your goal is to eventually to revamp it. And so maybe we could wrap up with just letting us know, you know, you don't have to put a timestamp on it. We won't hold you to it. But what do you have in mind for your website as far as, you know, putting new information on there? And if people want to learn more about kind of the knowledge you have, is that something that they can eventually will be able to find there?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because as I was my old website doesn't have any tree monitor stuff on it, you know, because that thing was built back in like 2009 or 10 or something. And I haven't updated it. And honestly, I haven't had the need to. It's just been like, now with social media and stuff, everybody kind of finds me. So I've been really lazy on that front, which is unfortunate. But I've been in the process of writing, you know, all of the descriptions for all the species of tree monitor that I'm working with and knobtails and all this stuff. Cause I had a lot of snakes when I built that one too. So that takes some time, but I will tell you though, I just, out of curiosity, I went to like, I don't know if I can say this on your show, but like a chat, I used ChatGPT and I said, hey, I need a care and husbandry and breeding information sheet for Varanus macrae. And, you know, said enter, what do you come up with, man? That thing wrote a pretty damn good care sheet, right? Like, obviously some tweaking, but I was like, oh, this is gonna save me some time, right?
Yeah.
But it was really good. It was actually quite good. I was quite impressed. I thought it was,
this is what you don't want your students to hear.
Yeah. Well, you know, they all know, man. Everybody, yeah, knows. It's no secret, man. Everything,
exactly.
But yeah, so I would expect that within a year I should have that up and running.
Yeah, I think that would be pretty valuable, especially with someone like yourself who has done so many iterations. I mean, you must be in the top, you know, and 10th percentile of people who have had that many iterations of captive bred tree monitors, maybe the most. I don't know how many people are working with it across the world, but
I would say worldwide, at this point, I think I've probably produced the most captive bred ones out there. I mean, there's some people in Europe that have produced captive bred ones of one particular species, maybe prior to when I did it. But like in terms of now of consistency and numbers, you know, I would say that I'm probably the most consistent in terms of having all the species. Now there's some people like I have a buddy in the US, Brian Susan from Sundown Reptiles. He's really consistent too. He just got into some of these other species much later than I did. So he's building up, you know, he's building up his collection as well. But like right now I have in the incubator clutches from every single species that I have, with the exception of the Varanus bulmii, right? So all the tree monitors, I have five different species in the incubator. I'm actually waiting for that golden photo where I can hold all six species of tree monitors in my hands, be the first person on the planet that can do that. But I have to get this last species to lay eggs for me, and those eggs have to hatch.
Right? Well, I feel like the other viral photo of the four, I guess, I feel like that. I know that you do have those photos on your page as well, but that's got to be the one that people see going around with the blue, the green, the yellow, and the black. That's got to be your photo, I assume.
Yeah, that's mine. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Although, be primed for another one.
There's somebody that tried to replicate that photo, and they just took a bunch of wild caught animals and put them in their hands, and they were all beat up adults, and they did that same photo. But mine's the one with all these little babies in my hand, right? You know, those are the captive bred ones.
Yeah, yeah. They're just sitting there patiently waiting for the photo to take. And that's yeah.
Great. Yeah. So, but well, so.
Brandon, you are a wealth of information. I think I think it'd be awesome for you to have that website up to give more. And I know last time we had chatted that, you know, eventually maybe down the road as a retirement project, a book would be fascinating. Cause as you said, there's no one that has more iterations of these things. And I think to pull that information from someone like yourself would be so important. So maybe that's something down the road.
Well, you know, I actually, this past year, I applied for a leave of absence from teaching, right? Just an unpaid leave. I wanted some time to work on the reptiles, work on the website, work on a book. They denied me. They said, no, there's a teacher shortage. We can't let you go, right? Like, I swear, this is a true story. I'm like, what? It's an unpaid leave. You really can't say no. And they're like, we can teach you. I'm like, oh man, fair enough, right? But I was like, so I'm trying. I just put in for a leave of absence for next year again. Right. I just put the paperwork in yesterday. So maybe they'll grant it to me and I'll have a bit more time on my hand, because man, it's like my day is full. Like,
Exactly. You can't do all that while doing a full time job. So maybe this time they'll let you take a year off for free.
Yeah, I hope so, but you never know. You never know.
In the meantime, this was fantastic. Thank you again for joining me today. Can you let everybody know, you can let them know the website, but also the social media platforms. That's obviously where you're more active. So if anybody wants to check out what you're up to, can you point them in the right direction?
Yeah. So my website is www.canadiancoldblood.com. My email that is a link to that website, I use all the time. So even though the website's outdated, the email, brandon@canadiancoldblood.com. If you have questions or inquiries, whatever, you can email me. I have lots of people randomly just messaging me. Hey, can you sex this for me? Can you, you know, does this thing look in good condition? Do these eggs look good? And I'll always answer your questions. So I'm always willing to help, whether you bought the lizard from me or not. Canadian Cold Blood on Instagram and Canadian Cold Blood on Facebook. Just do a search. Although I will say this, it's funny because I've had a few videos that have gone fairly viral, like had a few million views on like eggs hatching and stuff like that. And ever since the fall, I've gotten all these views. I've had a few people copy, like full on copy my Facebook page. So they've taken my logo, taken all my images and everything. And they've even tried to like solicit customers under the guise that it's me. So at most, I don't know of anybody that's actually been taken by there. I think there's one definitely. And I heard of another Canadian Cold Blood copy now where people are just trying to capitalize. I don't know how to get around that. I've tried you know, I've had everybody I know message Facebook saying this is a scammer page. Facebook doesn't do anything about it, right?
Yeah.
Clone, they don't care. So, you know, you can check out Facebook. You know, these new pages that were created, you can tell they're the fake ones because they only have like 50 followers or something. And then you could see my actual one. It's got, you know, whatever, 10,000 followers or whatever it is. So, you know, you be discriminate when you're looking at that and reaching out. And then again, if there's ever, if you were interested in buying something, shoot me a message. I'll give you my phone number. You can call me, talk to me on the phone. You can hear my voice. You'll know who you're talking to. Right. So, but yeah, unfortunately, that is the problem with Facebook and Instagram is the amount of scammers or whatever coming out of the woodwork now is just crazy, right? And I guess, you know, once you become more well known and trusted, people try and take advantage of that, right? So, but anyways, that's, you can find me on those two platforms. Just be wary. I know there is a copy of my page on Facebook and I tried and I've had everybody else that I know try and nothing seems to be ever get done about it. I know it's been copied, but just be careful on that. But yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's something we've talked about before, these pages getting ripped off and then people getting ripped off thinking they're buying something. And then as far as expos, do you typically just do the one expo or for those who are in Ontario or in the GTA area that attend expos in your area, do you do them more than once a year or?
I usually just do the CRBE.
Okay.
In September. I did do the last one here in, was it the end of February or March in Toronto? I did that one. Usually it's just the CRB.
So if anyone wants to say hi in person and they happen to be at the expo, they can drop by the table.
Yeah. Sometimes I'll just go to the expo and like walk around and pick up a couple things or whatever, you know, say hi to people there. But, I'd like to. It's just such a process. It's just such and part of my dilemma with that is I like going to the expo. I like seeing everybody. I like talking to people, and I like, you know, here's, you know, I like seeing people's reactions when they see the lizards. It's the setup is can be a lot. And the other thing is too, is like, I don't necessarily need to go to the expo to sell these things either. So it's not like a necessity. I more so do it just as a day out to get out and do it, right? So because of that, I'm not really drawn, because of the, you know, the non-necessity of doing it, I don't really do a lot of them, but I like doing them. But yeah, CRB, I'm always there. I'm going to try and do Tinley next year. If they will give me a table, I'll try and do that in Chicago. But yeah, that's typically the one. Although I'm not against trying to get out west and do like maybe the Red Deer show or, you know, the Montreal show. Like if Reptile Expo would get back into Montreal, I'd try and do that one, right? Just to get my stuff out there to a new audience that might not have seen the stuff in person would be nice.
Yeah. So,
yeah. I'm not against it. I wouldn't mind doing that, but yeah. And the other thing too, the Toronto Expo is, they're quite regular, right? So like if you were to do every month, it's like,
It's like every couple of weekends, you're packing up all these lizards. Like
same people with the same animals. It's like, it's nothing's fresh at that point.
Exactly.
Right. So at least when I go, I know that a lot of the people have never seen my stuff before. And at least when I go, it's different than the stuff that I had last year at CRBE. Mm. It's fresh. Whereas, you know, I know if I walk around at some of the monthly expos, you know, you see the same guys with the exact same animals. Yeah, you know, there's nothing new there. So, yeah.
Yeah. Better to keep it fresh.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Absence makes the heart grow fonder, my friend.
That's exactly right. Well, Brandon, thank you so much for joining me. If folks want to reach out to you, they know where to do it. So we'll have to do another one in the future again, because this is fantastic. So thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you for having me, buddy.
All right, that brings us to the end of that episode. Brandon, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. You're a wealth of information and just fascinating to chat with. Listeners, thank you so much for listening. I'm sure you gained a ton from that episode. If you have any questions or comments and you want to leave them on YouTube, please do that. You can also do that on Spotify as well. For those of you that don't know, Spotify does allow video, so you can watch the video on the Spotify version, but you can also comment. Fortunately, I can't comment back, but I do appreciate seeing your comments. There's a few of you that comment regularly, and that is awesome to see. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to help spread the word, just sharing it on social media does a huge amount of work. Just finding more people to listen to the podcast is a very important way that you can help the podcast grow. If you are interested in supporting the podcast otherwise, you can head to animalsathomenetwork.com. You can learn about our Patreon at patreon.com/animalsathome, or you can learn about the show's sponsors. That's all in the show notes for each episode. And I think that is it for today. Thank you guys so much for listening, and I will catch you in the next episode.